You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm.
My guest is Joy Williams, the author most recently of the book of short stories Escapes, recently published in paperback by Vintage. She's the author as well of the novel Breaking and Entering, the novel State of Grace, the book of short stories Taking Care, and a novel no longer in print called The Changeling. She's one of my favorite writers, and it's a pleasure to have her here. You mentioned in an afterword, quoting Nadine Gordimer, that fiction, good fiction, burns a hole into the page, and your comment was that, as far as you were concerned, that hole was W-H-O-L-E. What is a fictional hole?
Oh, what a well-phrased question. One of the reasons I'm so interested in the short story as a form is because I think you can create a whole and something, an experience that you perhaps don't recognize as much as enter into a total experience. And that's what I tried to do in my stories, and I think that that's what I appreciate in the short story writers that I most admire. It's overwhelming. It's can often be frightening, and it's necessary, even though you go in not knowing what is necessary.
What's always interested me is that in this contradistinction to one of the writers that I know you most admire, Malcolm Lowry, whose works are whole by being dense and fibrous and like a jungle full of its own kind of growths, that you manage to allude to a great complexity of metaphor without participating in the dense verbal foliage that one associates with Lowry. Can you comment somewhere along that
on
line?
On how I do that,
the thinning out
if and when
process.
I do it. Well, I work very, very slowly. I mean, Malcolm Lowry, I think, was a genius, although, many people don't read him today. And Ken Kesey once very much startled me when I mentioned Under the Volcano, and he said, "Oh, that's junior high."
And oh, God. What junior high did he go to?
Well, this is Ken Kesey, of course. But I work very, very, very slowly, and I dismiss such a great deal. I mean, the process, I would hate to even try to analyze it. It is so sort of painful and probably wasteful. But it takes me so long to get a sentence down that I've dismissed or condensed or suppressed or made words mean as much as I possibly can. I think that perhaps may be the lightning process that you referred to.
It's also, I think, unlike Lowry, the result, the impression of thickness in the midst of a great sparse style, the result of almost inhuman and systematically inverted values. I guess it starts in a certain sense with Flannery O'Connor and recognizing that the misfit in that famous story, A Good Man Is Hard to Find, is the character that O'Connor thinks might possibly be saved. But I think that when I was reading Breaking and Entering, the most recent novel by my guest Joy Williams, I became aware that this was, at least to me, a very moral and hierarchical book. It seemed to me to be almost about the afterlife or, you know, aspirations toward salvation. I know that many readers looked at it as a vaudeville of sorts, you know, and it got equally systematically poo-pooed, as if it were a collection of bon mots from dead lives.
Of weirdities, yes.
Yeah. Can you talk about that? Am I right, first of all?
Yes, you're very right. I was thinking that, too. I think the short story, just to get back to that for a moment, because I feel as though I've never known how to write a novel, although I'm pleased with Breaking and Entering. I think the short story is the closest thing we have to sort of a moral form. I mean, it's a method in which to really dwell upon, reflect upon the things that really matter, last things. I don't think the novel offers this. I don't think poetry does, in a way. I think it's oddly the short story, which certainly, the way it's considered to be in America, is a magazine, a form of entertainment. But I think it has a far more beautiful and sinister ambitions than that. And I think in Breaking and Entering, I wrote it in a way as I would with the same intensity of a short story. But no, these people long to be saved. I mean, they're not just crazies.
Well, when they go through their sea change, they, I believe, are carried by the ocean to their next house. They are people who inhabit the shelves of other people's lives in the form of people who break and enter, but it seemed very much a kind of survey of worldly goods and the soul in the process of disencumbering from them.
Well, as always, you know, I think most writers are never happy when they've finished with the work, and in a way, I think that could have been a better book. But at the same time, I was pleased with it because I think it did sort of dally and dare. And when a writer does that, you can, I mean, they're out there to get you to ridicule it, to say all manner of things. You're sentimental, you're new age, or whatever.
Well, yes, that was very amusing, actually, because there's a story in Taking Care where it seemed always to me as if the writer were quite apart from the new age person who is cultivating plants, although she is not against this cultivation. Mm-hmm. The level of metaphorical ineptitude of the character,
yes,
showed her hand from time to time. but then, sure enough, one would read New Age Joy Williams, yes. but you are, in fact, the daughter of two generations of preachers.
Yes, yes.
And yet, in the work, there seems to be, and I hope I'm not being presumptuous, a simultaneous running away from home quality, and yet at the same time, what's the fancy word? Resacralization?
Oh, my. Well, in a way, of course, you know, the Protestant church has really blown it. mean, but no, I the Bible has always fascinated me, and the stories in the Bible, and I never for one minute believed, even when I was young, that what was being said was, in fact, literally what I was to believe. And to puzzling out these stories is endlessly fascinating, and is you know, it's the way one grows in really trying to interpret and know that there is something beneath the words. There is some other world beneath those words, and some other form of understanding.
Mm-hmm. As if all of life and action were some translation of some sort.
Yes.
Yeah, and constantly in need of interpretation, or at least, you know, truth-seeking. The early books are full of quotations from some of my favorite poets, and even here in Escapes is a quote from the beautiful essay by Rilke, on dolls. I wondered whether you might speak about the poets that you most felt kindred spirits with.
Very much Rilke, and also the English poet Philip Larkin. I read.
Do you like his novels too?
I haven't read his novels.
Very interesting.
Really?
Yeah, The Girl in Winter is a haunted book. Mm-hmm. It's.
And Merwin, W.S. Merwin.
Mm-hmm. There was in the early book, I think, Kavafi and Neruda, and, you know, sometimes I remember feeling that these epigraphs or the quotations that run through a recent essay of yours in The Writer on Her Work are a kind of token to say, you're in good hands. You know, I am alluding to other members of the team.
Mm-hmm. That's funny. That's what Jim Harrison does that frequently, too. He blends all of that into his stories. And you do feel as though you're in good hands.
These stories and novels are full of spokespeople for a condition of earthly hopelessness configured in Escapes in a story called Rot, and I thought I would invite listeners to hear one of the most articulate spokesmen for the process of decay in the short story Rot. This is Joy Williams reading from her short story in Escapes, recently published by Vintage.
This is Rot, and this is a couple, Dwight and Lucy, who have recently acquired an old Thunderbird that has some serious problems with it, and they've been told about this, but Dwight particularly loves this car and wants to restore it. And so they decide to get a second opinion. They go to a mechanic named Boris. Boris was small, bald, and stern. The German shepherd that stood beside him seemed remarkably large. His paws were delicately rounded, but each was the size of a football. There was room, easily, for another German shepherd inside him, Lucy thought. Boris drove the Thunderbird onto a lift and elevated it. He walked slowly beneath it, his hands on his hips. Not a hair grew from his head. He lowered the car down and said, "Hopeless." When neither Lucy nor Dwight spoke, he shouted, "Worthless! Useless!" The German shepherd sighed, as though he had heard this prognosis many times. "What about where the leaf springs meet the frame?" Lucy said. The phrase enchanted her. Boris moved his hands around and then clutched and twisted them together in a pleading fashion. "How can I make you nice people understand that it is hopeless? What can I say so that you will hear me, so that you will believe me? Do you like ripping up $100 bills? Is this what you want to do with the rest of your life? What kind of masochist are you? It would be wicked of me to give you hope. This car is unrestorable. It is full of rust and rot. Rust is a living thing. It breathes, it eats, and it is swallowing up your car. These quarters and rockers have already been replaced, once, twice, who knows how many times. You will replace them again. It is nothing to replace quarters and rockers. How can I save you from your innocence and foolishness and delusions? You take out a bad part, say, you solder in new metal, you line weld it tight, you replace the whole rear end, say. And what have you accomplished? You have accomplished only a small part of what is necessary. You have accomplished hardly anything. I can see you feel dread and nausea at what I'm saying, but it is nothing compared to the dread and nausea you will feel if you continue in this unfortunate project. Stop wasting your thoughts. Rot like this cannot be stayed. This brings us to the question, what is man, with its three subdivisions? What can he know? What ought he do? What may he hope? Questions which concern us all, even you, little lady. What? Dwight said. My suggestion is to drive this car, Boris said in a calmer tone. Enjoy it, but for the spring and summer only. Then dump it, part it out. Otherwise you'll be putting in new welds, more and more new welds, but always the collapse will be just ahead of you. Years will pass, and then will come the day when there is nothing to weld the weld to. There is no frame, nothing. Once rot, then nothing. He bowed, then retired to his office, which was sheeted with one-way glass.
At the end of writing that, did you applaud yourself?
I seldom have enjoy myself when writing, but I did feel that that was a hole in itself.
That's Joy Williams from her short story Rot from the collection Escapes, recently brought into paperback by Vintage. I think of moments when I imagine you clapping your hands in silent applause, as when, at the beginning of Health, a father takes a daughter for what he calls her tanning lessons. His adorable way of saying tanning sessions, but to this reader, at least, one thinks of a classroom in which the body is taught to darken.
Yes.
Are those things the first to go in rewrites? I know you've spoken of humor of that kind as being the enemy.
Yes, John Hawkes refers to it as almost the net, the comic net, and how one relies on it in a way, because it does get very sort of tense and dark in there, and it helps you to proceed sometimes. It makes you feel a little bit better about what you're staring at. And I don't know. I think he was referring to Death, Sleep, and the Traveler when he felt that he had written a book without using the net.
Yes, he announced, "I no longer believe in comedy," which
yes.
is quite a theology.
But yes, particularly I think in a novel, I rely a little bit more on these riffs or these turns, just so it's not overwhelming.
The German Shepherd's so large that there might be easily another German Shepherd inside. I mean, these are the kinds of things I think that people who read and care about reading virtually live for. And to some extent, you've become bizarrely regarded like makers of sculptures in marzipan in Germany as a kind of specialist in this working, so much so that you've been stigmatized, I think, as a writer's writer. is that like being in the corner of the corner or the heart of the heart of the country?
Well, wherever it is, it's dark in there, isn't it? It's darkness. I don't know. I've got a lot of reviews in German about Breaking and Entering, but I don't know German, so I've got a little stack of them. Everyone assures me that they probably wouldn't have been sent if they were unpleasant, but far I haven't translated them.
I'm thinking not of your German reviews, but when I was a child, my father imported candy, and he imported candy from Germany, and this meant a cornucopia of pears made of marzipan, mushrooms made of marzipan, and the most extraordinary thing of all, a boy with his trousers around his legs sitting on a toadstool with a gold coin coming out from
made
his posterior, made of marzipan, the whole assemblage called, and I quote, moneymaker.
Now, how does this relate to say Boris and that German Shepherd?
Well, you know, to some extent, making, you know, bizarre objects out of almondy sugar. Pardon me, here I mean nothing by it.
Well, it's just, again, another quote, late great Graham Greene said that often readers reacted very strongly to, refused to believe in the creatures that he created and the situations, and because they didn't think the world was like that, simply because they hadn't noticed it, and so they didn't believe that it was there. But terrible things are out there, heavens.
As the book Escapes continues, the world, if you were to construct it out of these short stories, seems more and more a sick room or a convalescing place without much hope of eventual return out of the hospital room. And of course, you know, the world is sometimes that way. I wondered whether this is a, you know, ending with a short story that I think is sort of almost supernaturally beautiful, The Last Generation. The story tells us that you know, people who take samples of the fish in a particular swamp do so by lifting out a sample of water and then itemizing the fish there that are dead because of the sample taking. And that this, the story says, is what the last generation will do, notice the passing of things as they go. And I know that as a writer as well, you've written pieces against hunting and other forms of brutality. There's always the danger of savoring the brutal, because they do make effective scars in the surface of a short story. Do you worry about that?
No. I mean, I don't think, you mean because just violent, disturbed, destructive people are more interesting than, you know, than good preachers?
Yes.
In a way. No, I don't think so. I mean, that would just be being terrifically manipulative and almost sort of scorning the responsibilities of what you're trying to do in a story. No, I don't think I place freaks in for just shock effect. But you mentioned the essays, these, and I have been writing essays recently, and that you are able to write in a totally different way and be effective in a different way. Whenever I am sort of semi-successful about it, I get very nervous about it, you know, and I don't trust it anymore. I certainly don't trust doing it in the same way anymore. But in many ways, nonfiction enables you to write much more passionately about things that you care about deeply than you're able to in a work of fiction.
John Hawkes used to like, publicly and privately, to claim that he never read anything at all. Although, of course, if one engaged him, he was a big fan of Ford Madox Ford mm-hmm. and Quevedo, and, you know, there was no end to the extensions of one's reading list that one would come away with after a conversation with Jack Hawkes. You, too, like to say, while quoting from a plethora of writers, that you're not a reader. Why?
Do I say that?
Well, I remember,
I've never been aware that I've
I remember the
that.
First time I met you, I asked you a question, and you began by saying, well, I don't read very much.
No, I think everyone, we all read a lot. I guess we're all afraid a little bit that we're getting ideas, you know, from other writers. And I think certainly when you're deeply involved in a book, you don't read. You shouldn't be. I mean, it's all so fragile. I mean, it could just take a wrong turn that could take days, weeks to correct, you know. So I think you really, at least in my experience, when I'm working on short stories, I do retire so much from the world that I don't read, and I don't do much of anything else. I don't do healthful things like.
You travel
exercise.
Quite a bit. Do you stay in one place when you're writing?
Yes. I have to. I don't have good habits on the road or, you know, or on planes or anything like that. But it does seem as though I've been moving around the country a lot. But I live in Key West, basically, and then I teach a semester a year at Tucson in the University of Arizona.
The impulse to write The Guide to the Keys, it was the biggest surprise in the world.
It's terrible. Oh, well, my editor at Random House, he's no longer there, Rob Cowley, called me up, and they were planning, Random House was planning a series on places, the Hudson River Valley, Northern California, the Hamptons, and he wanted to know who could do Florida, if I knew of anyone. And I was in Sarasota at that point, and I was so bored with Sarasota. Sarasota is a town on the Gulf Coast of Florida that is so full of itself and so smug and so boring. And and I loved Florida very much, but I wanted out, so I decided I would explore Key West. I'd been there several times, but never really spent any time there. So I got involved in doing this guidebook, and it was a strange experience because I'm not a journalist, and I found that no one would talk to me. You say about the reviewers sometimes. I mean, I'd go up to these Chamber of Commerce types, and there was something about my manner or something that just made them totally look at me as though, who is this person? You know, I certainly don't want to give her any information. So I worked like mad on it, but I ended up really speaking to very few people and just gathering information. And then I made some wonderful friends in Key West, I mean, as part of the literary community. But as far as the people with the facts, I didn't get much from them.
Well, you know, the people like William Gass who talk about the world made out of words, it's sort of interesting to find a writer that one loves reconstructing an existing world in her own words, in the context of a tour book, of a guidebook. And of course, the book does seem to be written to some extent in a great darkness. It's pleasurable in that way. even though it's sunlit.
Yes, even though there's all this light down there. Yes, yes.
What are you working on now?
I'm working on stories, and a longer. I don't even want to say that it's a novel as such, because I know that it's all going to be years down the line, but I've got a novel in the works and more stories.
A last question. I'm always searching, when one talks about Under the Volcano or Miss Lonely Hearts or, say, Nightwood, there's always one more book to add to that small collection of permanently dark and wonderful novels. Some of them very well known, some of them obscure. John Ashbery from time to time will emerge with a De Quincey essay to tell me, you know, read The Spanish Military Nun. Have you a secret?
Of another dark favorite?
Yeah.
Well, one of my favorite books is William Styron's Lie Down in Darkness, which I just think is a marvelous book. He wrote it when he was, 21 years old? I think it's certainly an American classic. And Paul Bowles, short stories. I know now that people have discovered him because of the movie, so he's like destroyed for us all. But his stories, his work as a whole, is definitely something that should be in that sacred canon.
What about Jane?
Jane Bowles. Oh yes, she was the real genius. Of course, everyone says that. No, it's true.
But when I read Two Serious Ladies,
Two Serious Ladies is wonderful.
Thrilled. I mean, this show sometimes seems to me to be a monument to books like Two Serious Ladies. They come up so frequently, and the frequently invoked name of Donald Barthelme, a friend and teacher.
Do you know that wonderful quote from when Paul Bowles was reading Two Serious Ladies and trying to help her organize it, you know, and he was saying, Jane, you there are hammer and nails, and you're not using them. It's like you're making your hammer and your nails, and this isn't the way to do this. And she said, oh, really? And I thought that was marvelous that she, and that's why the books are so marvelous, because she just doesn't use the tools available to the novelist. She makes those tools, and then she starts to work.
It's the only way, yes, really, to work. I've been talking to Joy Williams, the author most recently of the collection of short stories, Escapes, recently brought into paperback from Vintage Press. Thank you very much for coming and talking to us. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. The land of ice is flowing books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold, and books,
books, books, books, books, books, books can be funny too.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.